It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up,
Rudy.
No, Rudy. Shut up.
Okay, hold on.
Shut up.
On.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia, Russia, Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
Welcome to All the President's Lawyers, the show presented to you by KCRW and Left, Right, and Center. On this show, we examine President Trump's legal adventures, whether they're about impeachment, emoluments, the enforceability of hush money payments to adult performers, accusing talk show hosts of murdering interns, or thus and such. And we help you make sense of them. I'm your host, Ken White, a litigator, criminal defense attorney, and former federal prosecutor. Josh Barrow, your formidable host, is on a well-earned vacation this week. And in the immortal words of Al Haig, as of now, I am in control here. This week, we were going to talk to you about President Trump's executive order directed at Twitter and other social media companies. But as riveting as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 can be, events overtook us. And we decided to pivot to an arguably more pressing question. Can the President of the United States invade Oregon? I'm referring, of course, to President Trump's threat to the use of the United States military to suppress rioting and looting that followed outrage over Minneapolis police killing George Floyd. Here's what the president said on Monday, June 1st.
If a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them. I am also taking swift and decisive action to protect our great capital, Washington, D.C. What happened in this city last night was a total disgrace. As we speak, I am dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, and law enforcement officers to stop the rioting, looting, vandalism, assaults, and the wanton destruction of property.
The president's proclamation followed a contentious call with governors in which he accused them of being weak and demanded that they dominate protesters, and threatening, ominously, to activate Attorney General Bill Barr and activate him strongly. So this raised a question we often address on this show. Can he do that? And because it addressed a legal area a bit out of my wheelhouse, I did what I always do in such situations. I went to Wikipedia. But after I did that, I did the second thing I always do. I found someone smarter and better informed to help me explain the law to you. My guest this week is Steve Vladek. Steve is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law. He's also a co-host of the National Security Law podcast, a co-editor-in-chief at the site Just Security, and an editor at the absolutely indispensable blog Lawfare. He's an expert on national security law. Steve, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So for the last week, you've been shedding some light on Twitter and elsewhere online on the president's power to use the United States military to respond to civil unrest. So can the president send in the army if he thinks governors aren't being forceful enough?
Well, I think, Ken, it's a complicated question that depends upon the facts that are on the ground. The old sort of line of statutes that are known, I think, informally and not very helpfully as the Insurrection Act, do give the president the power to use the military for domestic law enforcement in at least some circumstances. And some of those circumstances include domestic disorder, not too dissimilar from what we've seen, at least in some cities over the past week. So, you know, I think it is at least possible that the Insurrection Act gives him authority in this space. The Posse Comitatus Act, which a lot of folks, I think, you know, have long viewed as prohibiting that kind of use of the military, actually only prohibits domestic use of the military for law enforcement without statutory authorization. And so the million-dollar question is just whether the circumstances are such on the ground that it rises to the level that the Insurrection Act contemplates, where, you know, federal law is being obstructed and where state law is being obstructed in a manner that's depriving individuals of access to their full constitutional rights.
Well, let's back up for a second. Now, the Insurrection Act, the statutes underlying it, date all the way back to the beginning of the 19th century, right?
Indeed, a few years earlier. I mean, the run of statutes that are known as the Insurrection Act have their origins in a 1792 statute where Congress for the first time brought forward its constitutional power to provide for the calling forth of the militia to suppress insurrection, repel invasion, or execute the laws of the Union. And it's that third category, Ken, that's the big one, because, you know, this is not an insurrection, this is not an invasion, but to execute the laws of the Union, the idea there all along was that if we had a circumstance in which local and state authorities were inadequate, were either unable or unwilling to ensure that federal law was being enforced, and this includes, of course, federal rights protected by the Constitution, that the president would have the ability to use military force to ensure the execution and the enforcement of those laws.
Now, the Insurrection Act has been used in comparable circumstances before. President George H.W. Bush used it to bring in the Marines to my own city of Los Angeles after the 1992 riots following the acquittal of police officers who beat Rodney King. How is that different than the circumstance we're in today?
So, I mean, the one big difference between the 92 use of the statute, which is the last time it was used, is that in 92, at least, you know, then Governor Pete Wilson requested that President Bush send in the Marines and send in other military units to help restore order in the middle of the Rodney King riots. And that's one provision of the Insurrection Act, what's today codified at 10 U.S.C. Section 251, which says, you know, upon a request from a state, the president can send in regular forces for law enforcement purposes. But, you know, Ken, the other two big chunks of the Insurrection Act, which are Sections 252 and 253, are authorities for the president to use the military even without a state request. Recognizing that there might be circumstances where the state was either unwilling to request federal military assistance, or indeed where the state was itself the reason why federal law was going unenforced. And so, you know, one of the more famous uses of the Insurrection Act in American history is when President Eisenhower used it in, you know, the late 1950s to send the army into Little Rock to compel compliance with, you know, federal judicial desegregation orders. So, you know, it's not the case that these uses of force always require gubernatorial requests, but that was true at least the last time we saw this 28 years ago.
Now, earlier you mentioned the Posse Comitatus statute, which I think a lot of Americans may have vaguely heard of as something that prevents the use of the U.S. military on our own soil. Why doesn't that prevent what President Trump is saying here, that if the governors don't act to his satisfaction, he'll send in the army?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a fair amount of misconception out there about the Posse Comitatus Act. You know, I think it's one of those things that people hear about and then I think generalize in a way that may not be necessarily helpful. So the Posse Comitatus Act was enacted in 1878 at the very end of Reconstruction, and it was enacted basically to end a practice that had become quite common in the South during Reconstruction, where, you know, some especially forward-thinking state officials were trying to enforce these new federal civil rights laws against the KKK and against other, you know, former Confederate elements that were hindering the advancement of these new protections. And the best they could do to find bodies to help them, you know, physically enforce these laws, to help them push back against groups like the KKK, was their local federal army unit. Because remember, the army is stationed all over the South during Reconstruction. And Congress, as part of the series of compromises that augured the end of Reconstruction, says, no, you can't do that. That, you know, we're not generally going to allow use of the military as a posse comitatus. But we will allow it if we have previously authorized it. And so, you know, the misconception is that the Posse Comitatus Act is a categorical ban on domestic use of the military for law enforcement. It's really more better understood, Ken, as a clear statement rule, where unless Congress in a statute has specifically authorized use of the military for domestic law enforcement, then it's prohibited. And that's where we come back to the Insurrection Act. I mean, the Insurrection Act had already been on the books for decades. By the time the Posse Comitatus Act was written, it was understood when the Posse Comitatus Act was written that it was not precluding uses of force under the Insurrection Act. And so that's why, you know, when we talk about the sort of the climate today, whether the use of force is authorized by the Insurrection Act necessarily settles the Posse Comitatus question.
So I understand that previously there were more legal limitations on the use of the Insurrection Act, but that some of those limitations were allowed to sunset. So at this point, is the limit on President Trump's use of the Insurrection Act primarily legal, or is it primarily normative or political?
I think at this point, Ken, it's more the latter. I mean, the original statute in 1792 did have, I think, two pretty important external checks. The first was that before the president could exercise some of the most controversial authorities under the statute, he had to get the approval of a federal judge who had to sign off on the president's factual determination that the circumstances on the ground were such as to justify the use of federal military force. And indeed, George Washington, when he uses the precursor to the Insurrection Act to put down the Whiskey Rebellion, goes to Supreme Court Justice James Wilson, gets that kind of certification, and then uses force. And then the other real check was a sunset, that the president could only use the force delegated by the statute until basically 30 days after the beginning of the next congressional session. And keep in mind, this is a time when Congress was out of session most of the year. And so the idea was, you know, hey, Mr. President, we're going to give you the power to deal with crises while we're away. But, you know, you're going to need us to sign off pretty shortly after we get back. And as you say, both of those were basically allowed to fall out of the statute as it was amended over time. So that what that means today is that even though the statute does create criteria for when the army can be used, it says, you know, combinations too powerful for the regular course of judicial proceedings and various other formulations, every single piece of the statute can leaves that determination to the president. And it's not at all obvious that the statute really contemplates that anybody else is going to second guess those determinations. And that's why I think it's entirely right to say that at least today the principal checks are, you know, normative and or political, in the sense that what's really going to limit the president isn't the letter of the Insurrection Act. It is the popularity or lack thereof of invoking it. I think that's a big part of why it's been 28 years since we've seen an invocation. I think that's a big part of why, for example, President George W. Bush did not invoke the Insurrection Act after Hurricane Katrina, even though I think there was a pretty good case that the circumstances might have warranted it. So, you know, the politics are a big part of the story, which is also why I think the current moment is really complicated, because those historical normative and political checks don't seem to be operating quite the same way during the current administration.
Let's take a brief break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the president's power to use the military in the United States. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Ken White, and I'm back with Professor Steve Vladek on All the President's Lawyers. Josh is still away, and in the immortal words of He-Man, I have the power. So, Steve, it is clearly different, this proposed use by President Trump of the Insurrection Act, in as much he's saying pretty explicitly that he's going to do it if he deems the governor's response to rioting insufficient. It seems he's was saying pretty explicitly that it would be against their wishes, not by their wishes. But on the other hand, it sounds as if there's been some dissent within the administration. Several sources reported that on Monday, June 1st, before the president gave his speech about this, there were debates within the White House, and that some people were against this invocation, or even the threat of the invocation of the Insurrection Act. For instance, Attorney General Barr apparently said that it would be something that could conceivably violate states' rights and their interests, And Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, expressed reservations that it wasn't the right role for the military. Do those types of reservations expressed by institutional actors surprise you at all?
Not really, Ken. I mean, they surprise me in the sense that it's rare to hear that kind of dissent during this administration. But actually, historically, I think that's quite consistent. I mean, we were chatting before the break about the role that normative and political constraints had historically played in cabining uses of the Insurrection Act. And I think that reflects a couple of different principles. You know, Attorney General Barr's allusion to states' rights is one of them, that just about all of the most unpopular uses of the Insurrection Act in history have been circumstances where the federal government used force without a state request. So much along the lines of what the president seemed to be contemplating. But there's also, I think, you know, a critical way in which things have evolved on the ground in ways that make the Insurrection Act anachronistic. So at the time the Insurrection Act was written, you know, there was no police. And so other than the local sheriff or the local marshal, there really wasn't much in the way of law enforcement capacity for anything more than, you know, a small gathering. I mean, any sustained uprising was going to require some resort to military force. That's not true anymore. I mean, if we look at the capacities of, you know, our local police departments, state police departments, federal law enforcement officers, and, you know, can even the National Guard, which didn't exist when these statutes were written. I think part of what, you know, Attorney General Barr, General Milley, maybe to some degree Secretary Esper, are pushing back against is the notion that just because the statute is there, we ought to use it, when there are all these other capacities and all these other entities that are better trained and better tasked with the job of policing available to, you know, take additional steps to try to maintain order, to try to restore, you know, to try to restore order in these cities before we resort to the, you know, the constitutional Rubicon that you might cross by calling out the military.
Well, you mentioned Defense Secretary Mark Esper, and I think he's a good indication of how this story, as you said, is developing. As we record this the morning of Wednesday, June 3rd, it seems as if there's some fairly substantial backpedaling on President Trump's threat from Monday to invoke the Insurrection Act. Defense Secretary Esper, who earlier in the week said that we needed to dominate the battle space, which incidentally is also the model of my World of Warcraft guild, today is saying he does not support the invocation of the Insurrection Act and seems to be retreating from this, as do some other White House spokespeople. Does that sort of backtracking surprise you at all?
I think it surprises me just in the sense of how public it is. I mean, again, you know, I think what this has the feel of, Ken, maybe not for the first time, is that, you know, a small group of folks in the White House had an idea, the president ran with it, and then the broader constituencies, the broader institutions that would actually have to go implement this thing, push back. I think it is a reflection of exactly why the Insurrection Act has become so unpopular, right? That it's not something that the Pentagon is in any hurry to get in front of. It's not something that, you know, federal law enforcement officers think they need in most cases. And I think there is a sense, you know, that is not partisan, that is shared, you know, across the political spectrum, that there's just something corrosive about using the military to police civilian Americans in, you know, U.S. cities. I guess, you know, the backtracking to me may also, I think, be a reflection of the extent to which at least, you know, looking at this on a day-to-day basis, last night did not seem to be dramatically more violent than the nights previous. And so, you know, from the president's perspective, this may be less about, you know, can I use this authority than can I try to, you know, bully and cajole in a way where if things calm down, I can then take credit for it. And so I think, you know, the politics here are complicated, but they always are when it comes to the Insurrection Act. I think it's a big part of why, you know, we don't talk about the statute that often, and a big part of why it really does usually just sit on a shelf, waiting for a true emergency where it's really necessary.
You mentioned the National Guard earlier, and clearly the president has some powers with respect to activating or taking control of the National Guard. How does that power contrast with the power under the Insurrection Act?
Yeah, I mean, so the Guard is complicated. So the National Guard wears depending on how you count, either two or three hats. I mean, to broadly simplify it, and it gets more complicated if we start talking about funding. National Guard troops are usually either under what's called state active duty, which is shorthanded as Title 32 status, because it's Title 32 of the U.S. Code that governs the National Guard, or federal active duty, which is what's called Title 10 status. And the person who controls whether it's Title 32 or Title 10 status is the president. Basically, the default is that National Guards are under state control. They report to the governor of the state. And policing, especially during emergencies, is actually a pretty core function of the state guards. But that the president then has statutory authority to federalize the guard, to put them under federal control and to use them for federal purposes in especially dire circumstances. And I think, you know, Ken, the way this fits together is, you know, the federalization authority is parallel to the Insurrection Act. It is a statute that allows for the use of what are, for constitutional purposes at least, federal troops, the National Guard, for law enforcement without violating the Posse Comitatus Act. But like the Insurrection Act, it requires a formal act of the president to federalize the guard, to remove them from the state chain of command, to take responsibility for their actions. And we haven't seen that yet, right? That, you know, the Minnesota National Guard is still operating under the control of Governor Waltz, right? The California Guard under the control of Governor Newsom, and so on and so forth. The one exception to this, and I don't mean to get too far into the weeds, but I do think this is an important exception, is the DC National Guard. DC is the only National Guard where there's obviously no governor, but also no mechanism for local control. Even the Puerto Rico Guard has local control. And so the president by statute is always commander-in-chief of the DC National Guard, which is why the very, very first troops that we saw used in response to at least some of these protests at the federal level were the, you know, relatively small units of the DC Army and Air National Guard. Those units he can control without any special statutory authorization. There's no switch he has to flip to use them. So, you know, the Guard, I think, complicates the story in two respects. One, practically, the Guard, for the most part, mitigates the need to resort to the Insurrection Act, because the Guard is actually closer to the ground. In most cases, the Guard is often called out in advance of any need for federal troops by the local governor. And those authorities, at least so far as they're, you know, under state control, under what we call Title 32 status, don't implicate the Posse Comitatus Act, because in that context, you have the National Guard under state control doing law enforcement, doing policing. It gets complicated if and when the president wants to use National Guard troops from anywhere other than D.C., that's when this starts to look more like the Insurrection Act story, and where you need some kind of formal proclamation from the president that basically flips the switch and changes their status.
What I imagine also seems like less of a big step, because of the National Guard, when the governors call it out, is by its nature going to be people from that state. It's going to be locals, and it doesn't seem as much as, like, you know, using the military from elsewhere to come into a particular state.
I think that's right, Ken. The only complication here is, now this is, I think, getting even further into the weeds than you know, you might have wanted.
That's what we do here.
There are provisions for states to lend their National Guards to other states during crises. There's something called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, EMAC. I think Article 13 of which provides for the sharing and the marshaling of National Guard resources, at least at the state level, during these kinds of crises. But, you know, your point is the more important one, right? Which is that for practical purposes, having a National Guard that is local, you know, that knows the territory, that is responsive to local, democratically accountable officials, is a big part of why there's less and less need every year for the federal military to do policing, because it is increasingly the case that there's, you know, not a domestic disturbance that can't be handled by, you know, the men and women of your state National Guard.
So I think a lot of Americans kind of muddle all these concepts together. And one other one that I think they throw into the mix is the concept of declaring martial law. You know, you hear this thrown about all the time. And it's my understanding that governors can declare martial law in their own states or in segments of their states, which means a suspension of normal legal protections and rules. Can the president declare martial law?
So, you know, Ken, that's one of those great unanswered questions that law professors in calmer times spent all their time and energy fighting over. The short answer is, I think the answer is yes, but at least according to the Supreme Court, it would have to be in a situation where martial law had basically declared itself. And so what I mean by that is, you know, the one sustained discussion of federal martial law by the U.S. Supreme Court comes in Ex parte Milligan, an 1866 decision about President Lincoln's use of military commissions in southern Indiana in the middle of the American Civil War. And what the Supreme Court says in Milligan is that martial law is actually as much a factual state of affairs as a legal one, basically circumstances in which there is no functioning civilian authority. And so the military is in charge by necessity, as opposed to just because of some formal proclamation. And so, you know, the existence of functioning civil government, the existence of, you know, a mayor, a governor, a police force, a state court system, is usually necessarily an antithetical and anathema to the possibility of martial law. I think the danger here is that a lot of folks equate any domestic deployment of the military with martial law, that they assume that if you have, you know, Marines or Army infantry units in your neighborhood doing policing, that is tantamount to martial law. And, you know, historically, that just hasn't been true. I mean, in just about all of the deployments we've seen of the U.S. military on U.S. soil for law enforcement purposes historically, the U.S. military's job has been simply to backstop civilian law enforcement, to enforce the same laws that apply to civilians on an everyday basis, you know, to arrest for the same offenses, to conduct the same kinds of searches and seizures, not to enforce military law, not to, you know, use military rules. So, you know, I think the concern about martial law is a reasonable one, that a president might try to use the military to actually create the conditions in which martial law obtains. I just think it's right to think about those as separate concepts, that, you know, military policing of civilians is not the same thing as military imposition of military rule over civilians, because the substantive law in the former context is the same laws that bind us and that we follow every day.
So in other words, if right now looters or violent protesters are being arrested and prosecuted in the civilian courts, that means definitionally we do not have martial law.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the only sort of modern discussion of martial law by the Supreme Court is in a World War II case called Duncan versus Kahanamoku, which was about the imposition of martial law in Hawaii during World War II by the territorial governor of Hawaii, because this was pre-statehood. And, you know, the court, it's a bit of a tortured opinion. The court goes out of its way to avoid any constitutional questions. It merely holds that the relevant statute had not authorized the governor of Hawaii to impose martial law for most of World War II. But, you know, Ken, a big part of the court's analysis was that martial law was, you know, not lawfully available entirely because there were functioning civilian government officials, right? There was, you know, a territorial executive. There was a territorial court. There was a process for enforcing the regular laws of the jurisdiction. And I think, you know, that's a pretty powerful indicator of why, you know, martial law really is, it is a nightmare scenario, but it's a nightmare that can't just be created by fiat. It's a nightmare that results more from what's actually true on the ground.
I want to end by pivoting to a listener question about a related issue. We received this question after President Trump announced that he was designating Antifa as a terrorist organization. Some people say Antifa. Here's this listener question. What are the implications of Antifa being labeled a terrorist organization? What can or will the government do with this designation that it wasn't doing before? And have any other non-organizations been given similar labels in the past? It's a good question. And the answer is this. This designation is mostly performative mush. It has about as much effect as me saying that I've been designated America's most irresistible legal commentator. There isn't a federal legal mechanism to designate domestic groups as terrorist groups, nor is there a formal mechanism to impose legal consequences for such a designation. The federal government can certainly announce that they view a group that way, and they can start to use law enforcement resources in a way that reflects that view. But the president's announcement doesn't suddenly make it illegal to associate yourself with Antifa. This has actually been a matter of controversy for several years, as some commentators have urged Congress to pass laws allowing designation of domestic terror groups. It's often been in the context not of Antifa, but of white nationalist groups that have been violent at places like Charlottesville. But for now, it's not a thing. What is a thing is designating foreign terrorist groups. Under United States law, the State Department can designate a group as a foreign terrorist organization if it meets certain criteria. And they've done it for many groups. That in turn makes it illegal to provide substantial assistance to those groups, including money. One of the many things you need to know about that process is it's very political. The decision of what groups are freedom fighters and what groups are terrorists is about politics. And if it sounds like I take that personally, it's because I do. Because in 1999, I convicted a man for giving material assistance to an Iranian group called the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the MEK. They had been designated as a foreign terrorist organization, even though some people saw them as freedom fighters against the Iranian regime. Subsequently, years after I convicted this man, the State Department and the United States government decided that the MEK was freedom fighters after all, and took them off the foreign terrorist organization list. It was a political decision. As far as I know, the man I convicted did not have his conviction wiped out for being retroactively incorrect. So there's no reason to believe that a process of designating domestic groups would be any different, which is why I think it's good to be cautious about such a concept. There's so much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Professor Steve Vladeck, thank you so much for speaking with us and telling the audience about this stuff today.
Thanks, Ken. It was great to be with you.
If you have any questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, send them to us. You can find us at Twitter at LRCKCRW, or you can leave us a voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swatek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Ken White. Thanks for joining us. Josh and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.